My slogan is information applied correctly is power. Information by itself is not power because there could be erroneous information. But if you understand the key elements of information, apply them correctly, there's very few things that can get in your way.
Welcome to Manufacturing Happy Hour, the podcast where we get real about the latest trends and technologies impacting modern manufacturers. Each week, we interview industry experts that are at the top of their craft and give you the tools, tactics, and strategies you need to take your career and your business to the next level. And now, your host, Chris Lukey.
All right, it's episode 174. Today, we're taking a deep dive into the economy, the labor market, and the mergers and acquisition landscape, and specifically how manufacturers should be paying attention to what really matters in all three of these areas. Our guest this week is Alex Chosofsky, the Director of Analytics and Consulting at Bundy Group and a longtime friend of the podcast. Now, for context, Bundy Group is an industrial-focused investment bank that specializes in representing business owners and management teams in business sales, acquisitions, and capital raises. But Bundy Group just happens to be Alex's latest career adventure, and I'm going to let you know up front that this is a dense episode. That's because Alex knows his stuff in a handful of key areas that he's worked in the manufacturing world. He's worked for some very renowned economists that are very in tune with this industry. He's worked for one of the best recruiting firms in the automation and manufacturing space. He's seen a lot, and he knows a lot. And what's cool is Alex is going to share his career story in these three different but interrelated parts of the manufacturing and business world. And at the same time, he's going to share what he learned from those experiences. So here are three things that you can expect from this episode. First, we discuss how manufacturers should be paying attention to the economy and what they should be paying attention to, like what indexes and what they should not be paying attention to as well. This is probably the densest part of the conversation, but as we go through it, we'll do some recaps to make sure we highlight the biggest takeaways. Second, we'll talk about the labor market, hiring, retention, leadership development. You can probably guess a number of the topics we cover here, but what you need to listen for is Alex's personal perspectives on what it takes to win the talent game. Finally, we get into Alex's current line of work, which is investment banking. This part is really about what makes a manufacturing business competitive and potentially something that could be sold in the future. We've talked about M&A on this show a couple times before, but today we're going to tie all of these areas together. So it's economics, it's talent, and investment banking. Those are the three. And Alex came well prepared for this discussion, so he's actually going to share three things manufacturers should know about each of these areas. So you're essentially going to walk away from this episode with nine takeaways, and honestly, probably a couple more than that because there are some other gems that came up in this conversation. Having said all of this, this is why I would highly recommend checking out the show notes page today, because that page will be a great resource to dive deeper into any of these topics. And you can get there by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/174. I should also say the Manufacturing Happy Hour industry community would be another great resource to engage when it comes to the content of this episode. I'm going to be starting a discussion over there. This group is a group that's based on LinkedIn. That's where you can connect with nearly 700 manufacturing leaders that care about all of these areas, care about how they impact their businesses, careers, the industry as a whole. And this is where you can connect and build relationships with those folks as well. So expect some discussion on this episode taking place over there. Go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/community to get taken straight to that page. And one final announcement before we dive into the episode. I know we're going a little long here. I do want to remind you that Automate 2024 is coming up on May 6th through 9th in Chicago, Illinois. It's going to be their biggest event yet. More topics, more sessions, more education. If you listen to this show regularly, you know I'm very plugged in with the Association for Advancing Automation, A3. They're the group that hosts it. And by the way, if you want to be part of interviews like this, an interview that's done in the Manufacturing Happy Hour style, make sure you book an interview for Automate Live. I'm going to be hosting those along with some other great voices in our industry. So if you want to learn more, go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/automate2024. All right, we're nearing the 5-minute mark and we're just in the intro, so let's get rolling. We recorded this interview remotely, but Alex is going to pick a very nice virtual setting for today's conversation, so grab a passport and let's dive in. Alex Chosofsky, welcome to Manufacturing Happy Hour. Welcome back. You've been on our short segments before on this show.
Yeah, it's great to be back. Thanks for having me, Chris. Appreciate it, man.
And since we've got a bit longer this time, I'm going to ask you the appropriate first question for the show, which is, if you and I were hanging out in person, what would we be drinking and where would we be right now?
Boy, there's so many good options to choose from, but I think I'm going to have to go international with my answer. I would put us at the Löwenbräu Beer Hall on the grounds of the Hanover Messe trade show, which, as I'm sure most of the manufacturing listeners know, happens in Hanover, Germany in April every year. This beer hall is an experience for sure. So we'll be drinking Hefeweizen, you know, the German wheat beer. We'll be surrounded by men and women in Lederhosen playing traditional German polka music, having a good time. And on tables to the left and right of us, engineers from ABB, Siemens, and Schneider are going to be having contests where they're trying to build the tallest possible tower out of empty, tiny Jägermeister bottles. And we're just reveling in all of it, enjoying the good time, and having that delicious Hefeweizen beer.
I love that. And you're going to need to fill me in a little bit on this. And then I've got a story for you as well. So Löwenbräu, they do, like, is this like an Oktoberfest style beer hall that they set up, like size, vibe, yeah, all of that?
So it's not set up. It's a permanent fixture. So the Hanover Messe trade show, I mean, it rivals, if not exceeds, in size IMTS. For many of your listeners, you'll know this has over 20 different halls, each one the size of an IMTS hall. You have to take buses to get between one hall and another. And it draws in, you know, hundreds of thousands of attendees from all over Europe, from the Middle East, from Asia, from the US, South America. And so this Löwenbräu Beer Hall is, like I said, a staple. And they put on every evening a fantastic time for all of the weary and exhausted attendees that have been walking for miles and miles on this trade show. So you go in there, you have yourself a nice pretzel, you drink a good German beer, you listen to some jolly polka music and have a general good time.
The reason I ask is I was just at Oktoberfest in Germany this past year in Munich, and the last tent that I went to was the Löwenbräu tent, and it was a great way to wrap up the trip. And I don't know if you've been to Oktoberfest before, for the listeners out there, but Oktoberfest is an international beer party that just happens to take place in Munich. It's basically an amusement park, a state fair, and a beer festival all combined into one. And the major breweries in Germany, or I should say the ones that have been there for centuries, they all set up a temporary tent, but I use temporary loosely because, yes, it's temporary because they get built up and then they come down. But these are gigantic. Like, they feel like they should be a permanent beer hall. And we had a great time dancing on tables, hanging out with people from Brazil, Louisiana, you name it. People were all around the world there in Munich when we were there. And it was a fantastic time. So I can definitely get behind having Löwenbräu Hefeweizen, Löwenbräu Oktoberfest beer, whatever it is. That sounds like a great place for a little conversation going through the history of your career and a lot of the things you've learned along the way, because we were chatting recently and you and I have known one another for a few years now, but you spent time focused in the economic space, in the labor market, and now in investment banking. So you've got some very unique perspectives on these areas and how they impact manufacturers. So we're just going to go through your career story from the past 10 years. You spent 6 years with ITR Economics, and folks that have listened to this show for a while should be familiar with them. We've had Alan Bolio on the show before about a year ago. But you were there. Tell us how you got into that gig. Let's hear a bit about your personal story, and then let's hear some of the things you learned from it.
Right. Well, before I go into the ITR thing, I think it's very well worth giving a shout out to my friends and past colleagues at Interact Analysis, which used to be IMS Research. That really was the beginning. That's the group of folks that I went to Germany with and had those delicious Hefeweizens at the Löwenbräu Beer Hall. And that was, of course, market research on industrial manufacturing, electric motors, variable frequency drives, all sorts of automation products. So I spent almost 10 years under Adrian Lloyd, who gave me my first job after I got my master's degree, with colleagues like Tim Dawson, who's based in the UK, that leads up their automation department, and just an overall great bunch of guys. And it was from that organization that Alan Bolio recruited me for ITR Economics. I was doing a lot of presentations at the time, specifically focusing on, automation markets, I would say. So everything from rotating equipment, as we like to call it. So motors, controls, fans, pumps, compressors, through to fluid power, geared products, and then kind of some of the end use markets, on the vertical side that use all of those products. And so Alan said, I can teach you the economics component, but you've got the stage presence and the ability to deliver information. So I'd love to have you come join us at ITR. And so I actually relocated my entire family. We were living in Austin, Texas at the time. And in 2015, I moved to Bedford, New Hampshire, which is where I am right now, to join ITR. And I learned so many great things while at that company. Obviously, Alan and Brian are both very well known and very well respected in the manufacturing community. They've delivered thousands and thousands of presentations over the last 3 to 4 decades. And a few observations that I made while I was with ITR really stand out to me as it pertains to your audience. I really think it's important to kind of put them into context. So as I was thinking about it, came up with basically 3 key economics takeaways that the manufacturing community really should benefit from. The first one, and I'll go into these in a little bit more detail, but the first one is, you have to know which economy and which recession you care about from a business perspective. So you have to think about the data that is constantly bombarding everybody, how to interpret it, what does it mean to you, and which one should you care about? So I'll talk about that in just a second. Second thing is, you have to understand the impact that pricing changes have on company performance, both in terms of revenue and volume growth. So one of the key elements here is that I saw time and time again, companies, set themselves these pretty crazy revenue targets, not realizing that they really benefit. Like, I mean, last year's a great example. Many industrial companies had very strong growth on the back of healthy order backlogs and on pricing increases that were, in some cases, double digits strong. And they're continuing to look towards 2024. They're setting themselves aggressive targets, but the inflation story is totally different now. And so pricing changes are going to be harder to get across to customers. So I always like to say, you have to consider the impact on volume or unit shipment growth versus revenue growth. So that's the second element. And then the third one is really just this idea that you have to cut through the noise. There's a lot of information that's coming at you all the time, and you have to keep up with the trends that are meaningful. And the best advice I can give someone is follow the money. Right? Where are the opportunities based on where investment flows are going? And is the government supporting a specific sector? How are they encouraging people to, start new businesses in that space, build new capacity, and so on and so forth?
Okay, so let's do a quick recap of the top 3 things manufacturers should know about the economy, as we'll call it. Number one, know which economy and which recession you should care about from a business perspective. 2, understand the impact that pricing changes have in revenue growth versus volume growth. And 3, like you just said, cut through the noise, follow meaningful trends, and follow the money. I just want to bookmark those for everybody as we get into the details, because I know I have plenty more questions. So let's go a bit deeper, and then we'll take it from there.
I guess I'll start with the first one, which is kind of which economy and which recession should you care about? And I think this is a really key thing for people to understand. So companies often say, well, look, GDP growth last year was 3%, but I'm an industrial manufacturing company. Why am I down year over year? Like, what's happened? Well, GDP is 2/3 consumption driven. It's the money that you and I as individual consumers spend on going to the movies, eating out at restaurants, buying clothing, electronics, et cetera, right? So a manufacturing company shouldn't focus on GDP as a benchmark of its economic existence. They should look at things like industrial production, for example, or CapEx spending, right? Especially if you're a machine builder, which, you know, your business is driven by the ability of companies to borrow money to pay for big capital investment purchases, right? So how the consumer performs, whether or not we're eating out at restaurants, is not going to have a direct link to your business performance. You really care about what is the lending environment, right? Like, are the interest rates high? So that would be the first and foremost thing that I would say.
So paying attention to the right things. And what I heard you say was, hey, when we look at the big things, like your example, GDP, it was up 3%. But manufacturers might look at their business and be like, but why am I down right now? And what I heard you say, and please confirm this as we go along, because I just want to make sure I'm hearing all the right things and that our audience is taking away the right stuff. You're saying, don't necessarily look at GDP. You want to look at the things that more impact your business. So you said industrial production, looking at how that's performing. I heard a couple more from that as well.
Yeah, so there's a series. And by the way, all of these are freely available. The government publishes these figures every single month. You have to be kind of in the habit of following along and understanding what they mean. But this shouldn't be an expensive exercise for you.
Right.
Other series I mentioned was called Non-Defense Capital Goods New Orders Without Aircraft. It's a dollar-denominated series that basically stands for capital investment. It's the amount of money being spent on capital goods of large scale, capital goods. There are really fantastic series that also track producer prices. They track, like, the PMI is one of my favorites. That's the Purchasing Managers Index. That series has a fantastic 12-month predictive ability to foretell what the industrial economy is going to be doing over the next year or so. And there are many other series that everyone can have access to that will help them understand, you know, not what the overall macroeconomy is doing, but the components of the economy that really drive my business and actually reflect in my performance. That's the key element, is identify those series, pay attention to what they're doing over time, and make those decisions with the data's input. So it requires commitment, it requires somebody to own that process, and for you to make it habitual.
I love that. And I think the habit is an important part. And I'm going to link up to a bunch of resources in the show notes for anyone that's interested. But Non-Defense Capital Goods New Orders Non-Aircraft. I love the little asterisk that's in there
that's
as
right.
well. We
that's
will
right.
have links to the resources to pay attention to as you're looking at it. But I mean, I think my big takeaway from that is make sure you're looking at the right indicators that would impact a manufacturer's business.
That's exactly right. That's exactly right. And as you look at those indicators, you also have to then start to learn how to interpret the right input. So I'll use a couple of the series that I gave you as an example.
Mm-hmm.
Industrial production is an index. So it's kind of based on a point in time, and you're measuring growth relative to that point in time. So it's a measure of volume, not of dollars. The dollars are not, you're basically factoring out the impact of inflation, in other words, when you're measuring volume. Non-defense capital goods new orders, on the other hand, that is a dollar-denominated series, so that has the impact of inflation baked in, right? And so if you're going to set yourself a target for next year, then you have to understand, well, if I have certain expectations for what I'm going to do in terms of price, then I have to vary the goals for myself when it comes to my revenue target versus my unit volume target, right? Especially in terms of widgets, or if you're measuring something in bulk, right? That distinction is really key. One series from Federal Reserve Board, that's the Industrial Production Index, is a measure of volume. The other series, which is Non-Defense Capital Goods New Orders, is from the Census Bureau, and that's a measure of dollars. So understanding the nuances and the differences in those series will help you better set targets relative to what's more realistic as you look out towards the future.
So setting realistic targets based on relevant information. So I feel like we've gone deep into the first thing you said we should look at.
Yes.
What was the second one? It was pricing, I believe.
Yeah, pricing. That's what I was alluding to now, is like understanding the difference between a series that measures something that is impacted by inflation versus one that does not.
Uh-huh.
And being able to, I think the key element here is your goal setting has to be reflective of what is both possible and challenging, right? And I see organizations all the time say, all right, well, we're going to give our sales team this target, but our internal target for financial purposes is going to be a totally different number because we realize that there's not really a sustainable or a feasible way for the sales guys to hit that number, given our understanding of the dynamics of the marketplace, right? And so I think that's an outdated approach. I think companies have to understand that it's demotivating to a sales organization. When you look out towards 2024, manufacturing is currently slightly down, right? Relative to where we were a couple of years ago. You know that your orders are harder to come by. Your backlog has shrunk a little bit. And yet you're setting yourself growth targets on par or above what you achieved in 2023, right? That's setting yourself up for failure. And the effect that that will have is your sales team is going to be demotivated and they're just going to throw in the towel. Rather than being realistic with them, using these data inputs to set a target that's reasonable, but they have to work to achieve it, right? Even if that includes taking some share away from one of your competitors. But then everyone has buy-in and you're much more likely to actually achieve the targets that you're setting for yourself rather than, at the end of the year, well, good try, guys. No bonuses this year, but, maybe next year. Everybody loves to hear that, right? So that realistic price and target setting is key when you're leveraging these data series.
Yeah, no, it follows one from the other, right? Look at the right indicators and factor in things like you've been talking about. Look at how the impact of inflation plays in, because then when you're setting targets, you can still set challenging targets, but you want to do it in a realistic way that's based on economic indicators.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So we got number one, we got number two, and number three I heard was you got to filter out the noise. So what's the noise that people need to be careful of?
Well, a great example of the noise right now is politics, right? I mean, people know this is an election year. There's all sorts of expectations about what will and what won't happen. The reality is that politics takes up a large share of our mind space, but on the ground, in terms of business conditions and demand, it's not going to make that much of a difference. Nor, by the way, will it be very different depending on who ends up winning the presidency. There's a lot of data to substantiate that basically there's very marginal differences between when Democrats control the White House, Congress, the House, or Republicans. It's basically a standard deviation error. So understand that the economy and the markets in which you operate in are much bigger than the world of politics. And when you're looking for opportunities, I mentioned this earlier, follow the money, right? So you and I were both at the Rockwell Automation event last fall. I attended their investor relations presentation and Rockwell put up a fantastic slide where they highlighted five verticals that they think are going to be above average for growth. And the consistent messaging was there's huge amount of both public and private investment flowing into these categories. And I don't remember exactly what they were, but I think it was pharmaceuticals. I think it was a semiconductor. It was food and beverage, but more on the agribusiness and the snack side of things. It was things, that are renewable energy related. There's obviously a lot of government support for that. And the EV battery space. All of those categories have not only public support in terms of regulation and policy and investment acts and things like that flowing from the government, but then the private sector's coming in and throwing hundreds of billions of dollars at these opportunities too. So it's a fantastic way to say, all right, am I in those categories? If not, how can I give myself some exposure to those outperforming sectors? And maybe it's not a direct impact, but you start to think about your customers. You're saying, which of my customers are taking advantage of those trends? And that's where I should spend more of my time because those guys are going to be much busier than someone who's in an industry that's, in decline, for example. So cutting through all of the information means you've got to be able to tell which things to pay attention to and which to discard. And in this case, I would say politics should be largely discarded when you think about the performance of your business, but the money flows should be paid very close attention to.
Yeah, I like that. It even goes back to the first thing we were talking about in terms of, hey, what indicators do you pay attention to versus which ones do you not focus on as much?
That's right.
The same thing you were saying for what counts as noise or what usually substantiates itself as noise versus what are the things you really should be looking at? Where's the money going? I can tell you here in 2024, as you were saying, pharma, food and beverage, semiconductor. If I'm following the money as a manufacturer, those are certainly the areas that would have come to my mind as well. I know Rockwell does a great job of prioritizing where they're putting their focus. After, you know, I spent a good portion of my career there. So great example to use. I feel like that covers a lot of the economics 101 in our conversation.
We'll be back in a moment, but first, a quick word from our sponsor. Gray Solutions isn't just a systems integrator. They're a team of intellectual rebels on a mission to revolutionize smart manufacturing through innovation. Now, I've worked with a lot of systems integrators before, and I can say that the crew at Gray Solutions is the first group that comes to mind when I'm looking for a team with the creativity to solve unique problems in the automation world. While plenty of companies have the tech, Gray Solutions has the talent. Their 275 solutioneers and counting are in the trenches with their customers every day, collaborating and overcoming the challenges of modern manufacturing. At Gray Solutions, they let curiosity lead their solutioneers to develop better outcomes for the manufacturers they serve. And if you want to hear how they do that, make sure to check out episode 158 of Manufacturing Happy Hour for a full interview with their founder and CEO, Walker Maddox. Walker has stories that showcase his team's true expertise in digital transformation, OT cybersecurity, robotics, vision, process, packaging, turnkey solutions, you name it. You'll hear how Walker has created a culture where solutioneers are empowered to create smarter solutions and blaze new trails in automation. To listen, go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/158 or head to graysolutions.com to connect with a solutioneer today. When curiosity leads, success follows. And now, back to today's episode.
Let's jump over to labor and let's talk about how you got there as well, because the next stage in your career after ITR Economics was you spent a couple years at Miller Resource Group, a group that frequent listeners of this show have no doubt heard about over the years, easily the top recruiting firm when it comes to manufacturing and automation. Gary Miller was on the show about a year ago. Tell us how you found yourself there, and then let's get into some of the labor lessons.
Yeah, it's a fascinating story. I have to say, you know, I've been very lucky in terms of the people I've had to learn from in my career, and Gary is certainly at the near the top of the list. Travis, his son, who's now president at Miller Resource Group, another fantastic individual, and really everyone over there who's in the automation space, whether it's Sully, who I know you've had on your show before, you know, or folks on the food and beverage side like Gus and Denise, Adrian on the HVAC side. I mean, they're all a fantastic bunch and they focus on the relationship building part, which is why that company is so successful. They understand what motivates both hiring authorities and candidates. They bring people together and they create, you know, really lasting relationships. First time I saw Sully at a trade show doing his thing, he got probably a million hugs over the course of the day. And these are people that he actually placed in the roles that they're currently in. And they just felt genuine gratitude towards him. And I knew that I had joined the right company. But how I joined there was really interesting. So I was looking for kind of the next phase of my career. I tend to follow where I think the opportunities are going. And so I knew that there were fundamental changes happening in the labor market as part of the pandemic. So I had reached out to Gary and I said, you know, I'd love to have a conversation with you about, you know, potential opportunities for me so that I can leverage this trend. And he said, you know, we're actually having a company gathering. We're going to see, I think it was a White Sox game. Why don't you fly out to Chicago, come to the game with us, get to know the people, and we'll brainstorm. We'll just have a good conversation over a beer. And as I'm there enjoying myself immensely, at some point in the conversation, I said something along the lines of, isn't it interesting how companies say that people are their number one asset, but very few of them are actually approaching it from a strategic perspective like that? And Gary said, you know, I do think that's interesting. And I believe that the business community and manufacturers in particular need to hear that message. They need to be able to understand how to develop that talent strategy and how to be better and more purposeful when it comes to their hiring activity. So, you know, what does it take to attract people to your organization? How do you then effectively put them through the hiring process, onboard them, and then retain them for the long haul? So he said, why don't you join us? You can develop some content that you can take to the stage, you know, whether it's a trade association, annual meetings, or big trade shows, and you can deliver this message on our behalf. And I thought, what a fantastic idea. So it was very much an experiment. Nothing like this had ever been done before. There's never been an analytics and consulting arm at a recruiting firm in the past. So we wanted to give it a try. And, you know, the rest is history. 2 years, we wildly exceeded all of the expectations that we set for each other. We helped each other grow and learn new things. And it was a fantastic period of my life that really taught me, again, some nuances about the labor market that I didn't know before. And I thought I would share them with the audience today. So again, yeah. I came up with three things.
I'm going to stop you before you go in there because there's another takeaway in there. We're going to get to the three lessons in a second. But
okay.
I also think it shows what happens when a company decides to think outside the box and be innovative and bring in someone that may not have creating a role. This is essentially what it is, creating a new arm of the company that you came into. And kudos to groups like Miller Resource Group that have that level of willingness to try new things,
yeah.
Take a little bit of a risk. And you showed how having someone that has that analytics background coming from a company like ITR Economics can absolutely complement a company that was traditionally just focused on recruiting. So I thought that was a very cool part of the story. But we have a lot to learn from you. So let's go into the first thing that you learned from that experience.
Okay. All right. So the first thing is that the labor market really went through kind of an inflection with the pandemic. And the dynamic that has resulted from that is going to favor workers for a long time to come. I mean, things have really shifted. And companies that think that we're going back to the pre-pandemic norms are going to be proven wrong time and time again. And we can go into detail on that. But the change is here and it's here to stay. The second element is that the leadership of every organization needs to not only be both directly involved in crafting their strategy when it comes to the talent side, but they have to be willing and able to deploy their resources, meaning people's time, money, you know, and other resources to kind of craft that strategy and continuously refine it. It has to be malleable and adaptable, and it absolutely has to change over time as things on the ground change, right? So where we stand in the labor market today is very different than we stood a year ago, and it's going to be very different than where we'll be a year from now. So you can't have a set in stone strategy that just consistently applies no matter what's happening, right? That's number two. And then number three is understanding what motivates people. That's, again, both the workers themselves and the organizations that they work for is really critical to being able to not only attract people to your organization, but then effectively hire them and to retain them for the long haul, as I mentioned earlier. And so it's really fantastic when a company, when you see a company that does this well, and it makes them stand out so much relative to the rest of the crowd, which, you know, the vast majority are either kind of stumbling along trying to figure out, or some have kind of given up. And this is especially true with smaller organizations, particularly led by folks that have been doing it for 30 or 40 years. You know, it's tough to change and evolve like that. Not everyone's up for it. And you see companies that are kind of like, well, I guess it's going to be the next generation of leadership that's going to get us into that mindset, because the current ones are just not willing to make the difficult decisions and the changes that need to be made. So,
all right,
I think all of those things are key.
So number one, change is here and here to stay in the labor landscape. Number two, leadership must be adapting. And then number three, you got to understand what motivates people. So
that's right.
Let's jump back to the first one. Change is here and here to stay. So if I'm a manufacturing leader and I'm out there, I'm hiring people, I'm running my business, I'm trying to figure out remote work versus in office, all of these things that are on my mind. What's the best takeaway that I need to know about change is here and here to stay?
I think the key thing that you have to understand is that there is a fundamental disconnect between the supply and demand in terms of labor, and it's not going to change for the better in the foreseeable future. So there's going to be a shortage of actual bodies to fill all the jobs. Manufacturing is a great example. We had a very solid month of hiring last month. In January, we added about 25,000 manufacturing jobs. There are currently 600,000 manufacturing jobs that are open. And there's just not enough people, specifically with a high technical skill set, control engineers, you know, electrical, mechanical engineers, that will fill all of those positions. And so an organization must rise above. They have to differentiate themselves and say, we are better than the rest. And here are the reasons why. You know, this whole idea of elevator pitch where a candidate's trying to sell themselves to a prospective employer, that idea has been flipped on its head, and it is now companies that have to sell themselves on an ongoing basis to potential candidates.
Yeah, and it doesn't seem like that's changing anytime soon. And I have a feeling we're going to tie in understanding what motivates people, your third point, here in a little bit, because if I'm thinking about how to differentiate myself, that's a big one right there. So in that case, the second thing you were saying was leadership needs to continue to be involved and adapt to the changing landscape. So let's keep going on this. How would one do that?
Yeah, so I think the key element is HR has to have a seat at the executive table. And oftentimes I see that is not happening. So when you're setting targets for yourself for next year, when you're developing your product roadmaps, when you're talking about the future growth of the organization, people have to be a critical element of it. Bring in the folks that deal with people every single day, which is your HR department head or key leaders in that organization, and have their input be, you know, meaningful to the conversation. So the CEO, the CFO, the chief ops guy, all of these folks need to understand what does the organization need from a human resources perspective and what kind of resources it's going to take in order to achieve those things, right? So if you're crafting this talent strategy, the CFO is at the end of the day going to have to sign off of any budgetary increases that are going to fund all of these new additional hires or policies in the workplace that are going to make it a better place to work, all of these things, right? So they have to be involved because that's how you get buy-in and that's how you get continuous improvement over time. So the synergy between HR and the chief decision makers absolutely has to be there. And somebody within that executive team has to take ownership of the process, because it's nice to get together once a year and talk about it, but how do you monitor all the metrics, right? You've got metrics in hiring, you've got metrics in retention, you've got metrics in talent attraction. I mean, as you're watching those numbers evolve over time, somebody must be saying, hey, we're trending in the great direction. Let's do more of this. Or we're kind of staying flat. You know, what's happening? Why are we not seeing a better result? Or worse, we are actually seeing the numbers decline, right? Like, why is that happening? What lever do I need to pull to change that? So when I say an ongoing process, this can't be done once a year. This has to be done on a regular basis with check-ins and ownership, right?
Well, one thing that jumps out, and I'm going to relate this back to another topic I feel we've been hearing on the show lately. You mentioned HR needs a seat at the table. And when I think of someone having a seat at the executive table in this day and age, it goes back to a lot of the things you were just saying. They need to have the data to show why what they're doing is having a fundamental impact to how the business is performing. Because we've been talking about this a lot from a marketing standpoint lately, and how there's more data to go into marketing and why the chief marketing officer needs a seat at the table with the CEO. So total aside, at some point, I'm going to need to do an episode on, hey, what does the CEO need to be paying attention to when they're getting hit with all these different groups that have their data to show how they're having an impact on a business? That's a conversation for another day. But I think that's a great way of illustrating why HR needs a seat at the table and really what they can do to provide, I don't want to say the justification for why, but show the data of how they're impacting how the business is performing, how they're getting people, how they're losing people, whatever that may be. That was kind of my takeaway from that. Am I on the right track here?
You are. I mean, I'll give you a specific example, right? So each organization should have access to the offer to acceptance ratio, which means for every position that we offer someone, how often are people saying yes, right? Now, it's very logical. You can see that if a company sees that their offer to acceptance ratio is pretty low and staying low, something is wrong because they're getting people through the interview process. But then when they're making that offer, they're saying no. So it could be that their compensation is not competitive, you know, with the rest of the market. It could be that there's an individual during the hiring process that rubs people just so badly that nobody wants to work with that person, right? It could be any number of things. But if your HR person or whoever owns that process can report to you and say, hey, these are the adjustments that we've made, and we've seen that offer to acceptance ratio increase over time, then you know you're moving in the right direction. But most organizations don't even track that number, right? So it's a simple thing that doesn't cost a lot of money to keep tabs on. But again, most companies are falling short in that department. So that's a good example of, you know, the good, the bad, and the ugly in terms of what you could be achieving versus what most companies are actually achieving today, right? And that motivation, right? I alluded to the candidates, you know, and how they feel about the process. The motivation is paramount to every stage of your HR function. Getting people into the company, making sure that they get the right treatment throughout the hiring process, that it's efficient, that you know, they don't feel like their time is wasted, that, you know, that they get a good experience during that interview phase. And then for retention, the same thing, like what motivates people to stay at the business? You know, I alluded to compensation earlier. The last 2 years have been seismic in the terms of how much change in the compensation landscape has happened. And so companies have adapted, and some of them are actually hiring people at competitive rates. But then you have folks within the organization that have been there 5, 10, 20 years that are looking at this and saying, hey, that guy is coming in making as much, if not more, than what I'm making, and I've been here for 20 years. So there's this like resentment and disconnect that it is there. So all of that is to say, there are some very basic things, again, not rocket science and not expensive, that companies can implement to improve their communication and their ability to motivate individuals to behave the way that they want candidates to behave in, right? So a great example from the Miller Resource Group, they have something called a CLAMPS profile. A CLAMPS stands for Challenge, Location, Advancement, Money, People, and Security. It's a very basic 6-box questionnaire. It says, rank these six things in order 1 to 6 of what's most important to you. What we've discovered is that it varies greatly, right? Some people care more about money and advancement. Others care more about the challenge of the job and security. Others care more about the team that they're joining and, you know, remote work and other things. So the motivating factors change from person to person. And if you can learn what they are and then encourage the people conducting the interviews to talk to those things that the person cares about, then of course you're going to have a better outcome of the process than if you're just doing the generic rigmarole, you know, same conversation, no matter who's sitting across the table from you. So very basic things like that, again, that companies can do to make a huge impact.
I like that example. And I'm going to we'll recap those CLAMPS aspects real fast, because C is challenge, L is location, M is money. Hit me with the other three, because I'm slipping on this
challenge,
right now.
Location, advancement is A, money, people, and security. So, you know, the compensation element, the team that they're going to be joining, how, you know, the longevity of the work. I mean, in some cases, security can actually mean physical security. Like, you know, am I working in a dangerous, hazardous environment or not, right? Things like that. So again, 6 words with boxes next to them, put a number in there, 1 through 6, which one do you care the most about? Send that questionnaire in before you come in for the interview, and then that interviewer actually has access to that information and uses it in the conversation. Totally different experience for the candidate.
Well, I like that, because I think whether someone is listening to this as a hiring manager, someone that hires people for their team, they can take something away from the CLAMPS acronym. But I also think people that are in a role today that may be asking themselves, you know, this role just doesn't feel like the spot that I'm supposed to be for the rest of my life. They can start looking at that and reflecting on, oh yeah, okay, how does, you know, what do I really want? Is it the money? Is it the security, safety, like you were talking about? Is it the location, flexibility? I think it's a good self-exercise to reflect on that as well, to be like, hey, does this job have the challenge I want right now? Does it have the location I want? Does it have the advancement opportunity I want? And so on and so on. So very relevant advice for the whole gamut of our audience here. And that takes us through the labor market portion of our conversation.
Next round of our interviews coming up right after a word from our sponsor. This episode is sponsored by Swipe Guide. Swipe Guide is helping frontline workers perform at their best through standard work instructions and skills development. Their clear-cut platform lets frontline teams coordinate instructions, job aids, and training to optimize processes. All of these aspects add up inside of a manufacturing operation, keeping motivation high and operations running. I mean, Swipe Guide is right in line with one of our biggest themes here on Manufacturing Happy Hour, empowering frontline teams. Their customers are saying the same thing. Here's a quote from a recent review. Swipe Guide has been fantastic for empowering our operators. They now have all the information and knowledge they need to do their jobs at their fingertips. Plus, if you really want to hear how Swipe Guide is making a difference for manufacturers, then head back and listen to episode 167, where Swipe Guide CEO Willemijn Schneider and Joris Stolk from Heineken jump on the show to discuss how Swipe Guide's impacted their global brewing operations. If you're a regular listener here, you know that talking about how technologies apply to brewing is certainly one of our favorite topics on the show. And you can get to that episode by going to manufacturinghappyhour.com/167. If you're looking for a hassle-free solution for sharing how-tos and boosting know-how across frontline teams, then look no further and head to swipeguide.com today. And now, back to today's interview.
So, the final chapter here is into what you're doing now. So, you're in investment banking now, so tell us how you got there.
Yes, I am with a company called Bundy Group, and it's a boutique investment bank out of Charlotte, North Carolina. And the way that I got here really has a lot to do with that earlier trend that I mentioned of following where I think the opportunities are. And so what I see happening right now as more and more baby boomers retire, you know, now we're up to 12,000 people per day going into retirement. Many of those people are business owners, and they need good, valuable, and insightful information about the M&A space, like what makes a company valuable, how do they go through if they want to do a sale, you know, whether it's to a strategic buyer, if it's to a private equity group, maybe they want to set up an ESOP and give back to the people that they built the company with, but they need something that's unbiased, right? Independent, and gives them the information that they're looking for to make the biggest decision for many of them in their entire lives, right? These companies reflect their whole life's work. And so it's important to have the outcome that they want to get out of that experience. So Bundy Group, we specialize in, you know, sales and capital raises for companies, roughly speaking, of revenue up to about $100 million, EBITDA in the like $3 to $20 million range. A key observation that I had was, you know, this trend of exits and transitions is only going to accelerate as we get out into the 2030s. You know, most of your listeners will have heard ITR speak of 2030s and kind of some of the risks associated with that period. So I thought, you know, this is a great opportunity for me to come in and help the investment bank and learn a lot about M&A and investment banking myself. And so here I am.
Yeah, and I think this is a great opportunity to go back to Germany to the Löwenbräu Beer Hall to say, you're sitting across the table from, you know, let's say a director of operations, someone in manufacturing who wouldn't typically deal with investment banking or M&A, for example. But how would you describe why it's important to have at least a base understanding of this area to someone that, like I said, it's not necessarily the thing they're doing day in and day out, but hey, they're still in the industry and they should have an understanding of what this means when someone's throwing around acronyms like IB, for example?
I think the first and foremost reason why it's critical for them is they need to understand what comprises the value of their organization. Like, what is it that companies need to focus on in order to be viewed as valuable, right? And I think that's one of the three elements that I came up with for this segment, that is, there's really kind of four pillars to a valuable business. They are stability, profitability, growth, and then the fourth one being kind of the team and client diversity and resiliency. So let me explain. Stability means you don't want to have boom and bust cycles. You want fairly stable revenues over time. Companies that are in, you know, heavy process sectors, commodity related sectors like oil and gas, for example, they go through fantastic years, but they also, you know, you remember oil at minus $20 a barrel, right? Like they go through these crazy ups and downs. It's very volatile. That's risky. People want more stability. Profitability is easy, right? If you're not making a profit, then something is wrong with your business. So you got to keep an eye on the bottom line. You got to make sure your margins are right and you got to be making a profit. That's what most companies forget, that they're not in business to grow revenue. They're in business to make a profit, right? That's the whole thing at the end of the day, is how much money is left over after you cover all your costs. So profitability is key. Growth, right? You want a company that consistently is able to grow over time. That could be organic growth, like through natural market expansion, taking market share. That could also include inorganic growth, meaning M&A activity. So acquisition of other companies that you think present opportunities. And then the last element is the team and the client diversity and resiliency. So two different elements here. Team, the management team has to be able to survive the exit of the owner, right? There have to be capable, smart, intelligent people that know how to run the business besides yourself. The client side, what you're looking for is not having all of your eggs in one basket. You want a diverse mix of industries so that you're not susceptible to those boom and bust cycles. You want a combination of, you know, discrete and process. You want a combination of consumer facing versus business facing. You want to take a little bit of opportunity in the growth sectors. You want to also have the kind of the staples represented. So when investors look at a business and try to determine its value, the more diverse their client base is, the more resilient they think that the company is going to be. And within that, the more you can have on a recurring revenue basis rather than one-off big projects, the more admirable your company looks to a potential investor as well. So that's the first thing is I would say, you've got to understand what it is about your company that is viewed as valuable by external sources in the market.
Yeah, that's incredible. That's a great beer conversation too, because I think anyone that's going to watch the video might get a kick out of how much I've been typing on my computer, taking notes to keep up with this. But I think it makes a lot of sense because, again, thinking about the audience out there, some of them are leading companies. Some of them are brand new to the business, for example, but it's a great way. Those four things you just mentioned that, hey, what makes up a good business? How stable is it? Is it going to boom or bust? Like I was in the oil industry from 2011 to 2015, which was a good time to be there. You know, you talk about following opportunities and where things go. And, you know, I guess a little, knock on wood, a little bit of luck. I got out at the right time, but you mentioned profitability. It's not just all about revenue. You talk about growth. And I love that team client diversity you mentioned. When you think of the team, you gave a very perfect example of what it means to have team diversity. Will the business survive without the owner? And then client diversity, are your eggs all in one basket, right? You got to look at that too. I love that summary. I could easily see myself having that conversation at a bar later this week. But hey, we talked about number one here. What makes a good business attractive to an external buyer, for example? Yep. What's number two?
Number two is that there is a strong correlation between the business cycle, that economic data that I talked about in the very beginning of our conversation, and what happens with company multiples or valuations, right? But at the same time, everyone needs to realize that a business that has those four key pillars that I mentioned will always sell at a premium relative to the rest of the folks. So even if the market is overall market is down, for example, if you look at the total state of M&A, 2023 was a relatively weak year, largely because of high borrowing costs and, you know, the interest rate environment and all of that. But there are still transactions happening. Those transactions tended to focus more on the smaller side of the market, so the small and medium market cap rather than the big, you know, multi-billion dollar sales. And specifically in the automation space, there were fantastic sales with high multiples above market average going on. So you've got to understand where you are from a timing perspective, but also know that you can influence the value of the company if you have the things that I mentioned before, right? And that really is what it's all about. I'm coming to the third thing from an investment banker's perspective is, if you are of a mindset that at some point you're going to consider selling a business, what you really should strive for is a competitive market process, because that's how you're going to get the best bang for your buck. Meaning, a lot of owners will have someone just call them directly and say, hey, I'm with this company, I want to buy your business. It's a one-on-one transaction. There's no bidding process. There's no validation happening of, you know, why is it, are they motivated to buy you? Are they going to absorb you, cut all of your staff and just take the IP, like that kind of thing, right? So that's what an investment banker, a really good one, actually does. It provides the owner with a bunch of options and brings a pool of well-fitting, highly qualified potential buyers to the conversation so that there's, you know, some competition for that particular business. That's what a business owner should know about investment making. As with all services, yes, there is a cost associated with it, right? If you go to buy or sell your house, you're going to pay a realtor, you know, a fee for their expertise and their knowledge. The same idea applies to investment banking. We help the business owner community achieve a much more optimal outcome and present them with a lot of options as well as advice, of course. So if you know those three things, then you know the basic gist, the 101 of investment banking. The one funny thing that I'll end with is it's been surprising to me how often investment bankers have to be playing the role of a therapist in the conversation. These transactions, as I alluded to earlier, this is the culmination of someone's life's work, right? There's a lot of emotion involved and a lot of considerations. How does it impact the people that you're leaving behind? What is it going to do for my family, right? So you're kind of guiding someone through this process. And a lot of times it's highly emotional type of work. So I found that to be fascinating. I was not prepared for that when I first joined the Bundy Group, but it's probably my favorite part of that is that you do really get into the weeds with people and you share in their collective experience.
Yeah, I like what you were saying there at the end, striving for a competitive market process. If you're ever going to sell your business, you know, you compared it to a realtor. I think that's the perfect one-to-one comparison because a realtor is going to help you get the best return when you sell your house. It's the exact same thing when you're looking at selling a business. And actually, the other thing, when you said strive for a competitive market process, the word process came to mind because going back to your earlier point, you need to have a business that can survive beyond the current owner of the company. Having processes is what makes that possible. When I, even as a solopreneur that runs my own, you know, solopreneur gig with the podcast right now, I need to make sure I have processes, one, so I can execute on my business in an efficient way, but also so that I can outsource that stuff. And again, make it such that the business isn't always relying on me as the owner, creator, all of that.
Right. Work on the business, not in the business, right? You got to take opportunities to do that as well. So that's a key element for sure.
Well, I know we're getting to the end of our conversation here and we went into a good amount of detail on all these spots. This is going to be a masterclass in a number of areas that quite frankly are highly related. You've tied them all in, how economics, labor, investment banking all work together throughout the string, the thread of your career. Alex, are there final thoughts you want to leave the audience with before we roll out of here?
Oh, I think that, you know, we live in a world where there is a agenda that exists and people try to convince you of certain things because it benefits them. And I think one of the things that at least I've observed is we seem to have gotten less apt at being able to tell what's really important from what's not. So it's that critical thinking component that really makes for a good business leader and a decision maker at the end of the day. I think all of the areas that I covered, whether it's the economics, the labor market, investment banking, or, you know, the market research, the early stages of my career, all of them have that commonality is you're looking at information. You're trying to say, all right, I'm going to put my emotions to the side. I'm going to put my fears and my enthusiasm, exuberance over to the side. I'm going to say, what is the data telling me, right? Because the data doesn't lie. The data says information that is factual. And if you can learn to be more data-driven in your decision-making process and less emotionally driven or fear-driven, right, or exuberance-driven, you don't want the extremes. You want to be straight down the fairway, make those well-informed decisions using data that you can rely on, that is accurate and consistent over time, then you're going to be successful in running that business. And that's what I hope the audience takes away from the entire conversation that we have today.
Yeah, I think the theme I was hearing, it's like, hey, you got to be paying attention to the right things in all these things, whether we're talking economics, whether we're talking labor. And I like how you highlighted looking at the data at the end of the day, because in all these areas, there is more data than we ever could have imagined to help us make these decisions and pay attention to the right area. But at the same time, there's so many more distractions out there that can easily get people caught up or unfocused on what they need to be looking at.
My slogan is information applied correctly is power, right? Information by itself is not power, because there could be erroneous information. It could be skewed. It could be agenda driven. But if you understand what the key elements of information that you need and apply them correctly, there's very few things that can get in your way. So that's what I hope the listeners take away from our conversation today.
Well, I'm going to have links to connect with you, to connect with Bundy over in the show notes. And in the meantime, I think I'm going to need another like fest beer at the Lowenbrow tent to digest all this. So, Alex, I just want to thank you so much for taking the time to jump on today's show.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me, Chris.
Cheers.
Take care.
Hey, thanks for listening. As I said, if you want to learn more, if you want to dive into an outline of today's conversation, go to manufacturinghappyhour.com/174. That'll take you to the show notes page. There you can find links to a few of the resources Alex was recommending when it comes to how manufacturers should be paying attention to the economy. It's a great resource, particularly for this episode. But since this was a big one, I do want to share a couple of my personal takeaways from this conversation. First, when it comes to economics, pay attention to the right things like industrial production or CapEx spending. Industrial production as an index, you're measuring growth relative to that point in time. You're measuring volume, not dollars. That part was super helpful for me to hear in terms of like goal setting and understanding that that measure does not include the impact of inflation, whereas non-defense capital goods orders excluding aircraft, that is one that does factor in inflation. On the hiring front, the offer to acceptance ratio was one of the big measures that I heard to figure out if you're offering competitively when you're providing offers to candidates, or hey, is maybe someone in your organization rubbing someone the wrong way, right? That goes back to the data that you have to look at your hiring process and make some objective decisions. And then finally, from a mergers and acquisition standpoint, creating processes to make your business attractive to a buyer. That's something I've taken away from this show before and previous episodes where we've talked about this. But the thing I'd like to drive home is I don't think of that in terms of just making your business more attractive to a potential buyer. Doing those things like adding processes, making sure your business is bulletproof beyond the current ownership, that all makes your life easier when you're running the company in the present day as well. So a few of my biggest takeaways from this conversation, I mentioned the show notes page where you can go to learn more from this conversation, manufacturinghappyhour.com/174. As we wrap up, just a few more housekeeping items. First, hey, you heard us talking about Gary Miller from Miller Resource Group quite a bit in the middle of the interview. Well, hey, he was on episode 126 of Manufacturing Happy Hour, where he shares his lessons from basically four decades in the manufacturing and automation world. It's a real history lesson in our industry, and some great sage leadership wisdom gets shared in that one as well. I certainly want to thank our sponsors today, Swipe Guide, as well as Gray Solutions. And then one final shout out for Automate 2024. Sign up for that event. It's in Chicago, Illinois, May 6th through 9th. You can sign up for Automate Live interviews, or you can register for free for the event as well. And then finally, I told you I'm going to be having conversations about this episode over at the Manufacturing Happy Hour industry community. Again, that group is on LinkedIn, but this link will take you straight there, manufacturinghappyhour.com/community. All right, that's a wrap. Stay innovative, stay thirsty, folks, and we'll catch you again next week. Roast!
Thanks for listening to Manufacturing Happy Hour, powered by the Industrial Network.